On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to today's Conversation Hour, where you're going to learn about some things that are going on in your city and your state that will astonish you, quite frankly. You'll hear about Creative State, which is a new slogan that's being bandied around, buried in jargon, I might say, but we'll strip that away for you. You'll hear about Creative State. There's a summit, there's a program, there's money, all sorts of things being splashed around in order to create a creative state. And you're also going to meet the curator of the next winter masterpiece here at the National Gallery in St Kilda Road. This, every year now, for years and years and years, has been one of the major draw cards in Melbourne's art scene. Juliet Kinchin is over here from New York, from the Museum of Modern Art, from MoMA. MoMA's found a few bits and pieces lying around, stuff they didn't need that was sitting in storage, and said, here, why don't we just all pack it off? We'll put some bubble wrap around it and punt it off to Melbourne for the Winter Masterpiece Exhibition. And, look, the odd Picasso, you know, a few Lichtensteins. We'll just whack a few things in the crate, send it over there and see what they make of it. Well, there's a bit more to it than that. And Juliet will be joining us to take us through this latest Winter Masterpiece, which is about to open, on The Conversation Hour. That's between now and noon. My co-host, my interpreter for all of this, is Katrina Sedgwick. She's the former head of arts for ABC TV, Adelaide Film Festival founder, and now, though, the director of ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image in Fed Square. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Bit going on.
So much going on. It's amazing. It's quite incredible to be working in the sort of arts and creativity sector in Victoria at the moment, it has to be said.
So what's this creative space that's just been announced? It's a collaboration between the library and ACME.
Yeah. So Creative State that you've been talking about, you know, there is a really kind of powerful sense that Melbourne is the kind of cultural capital of Australia. Mm-hmm. And there's been a whole lot of kind of investment and research going into kind of measuring what the impact is of creative industries in this state. And it's really significant. It's about 8% of our economy. It's billions of dollars worth of our earning capacity. And what Creative Victoria wanted to do was to invest some money in developing businesses right across the creative industries, be they theatre companies, be they architectural firms, be they startup app developers, be they fashion designers,
gamers,
be they gamers, be they filmmakers, whatever they are, to be able to get support to develop the business skills that they need to become more successful entrepreneurs. So it's.
Can we go back a step?
Yeah.
What's Creative Victoria?
Creative Victoria is part of the state government. It used to be Arts Victoria.
Ah.
Yeah, and so it's the funding body that's kind of charged with government to support, invest in and strategically develop the
arts,
creative industries.
Arts Victoria has broadened its ambit. It's now called Creative Victoria.
That's right, and it really reflects the fact that the arts is part of a very broad creative sector that embraces design, embraces architecture, it embraces sort of user experience. It embraces a whole lot of areas of creative imagining, ingenuity, innovation.
But also an economy.
And vitally, economy. And
we
those
talk about
things,
the sport economy and the contribution, the major events and so on. Well, creative events and creative life contributes in incredible ways, tangible, intangible as well.
And more and more. I mean, as we're kind of turning, you know, pivoting as a nation towards this knowledge economy and we're embracing innovation, creativity is foundational to that, you know, across so many applications. So it's really exciting to have this kind of very focused investment in the creative industries. You know, the sort of tech startup area has been in this space for quite a long time, and a lot of investment has been going into these sort of methodologies that enable sort of young businesses to harness these kind of good ideas, but to develop them up to something that can successfully enter the marketplace. And the arts haven't had that investment, and now we've got it. So it's really exciting. ACME is going to work with State Library of Victoria to deliver this program right across Victoria over the next couple of years. There's going to be a whole lot of kind of regional programs, because there's a lot of opportunity to really foster small creative startups in regional areas. There's going to be a lot of kind of boot camps, and we're looking at about 50 different companies going through boot camps.
What's a creative boot camp?
A creative boot camp is, again, well, it's like a startup boot camp.
What's a startup boot camp?
A 2-week intensive.
Sorry to do this to you, Katrina.
No. It's
the trouble is that, like, every particular, whether it's medical jargon or whatever it is, it becomes a language of its own and no one else knows what it means.
And I've been on a learning curve of doom trying to get my head around all of this, because we've just been running our first accelerator program just recently at ACME.
What's an accelerator program?
So, well, this is all part of it. I'll go through step by step. A boot camp is where you spend a couple of weeks with a significant number of people, and in this case there'll be a number of boot camps with sort of between 10 and 20 companies in them. And you go at fast pace through the kind of basics of what you need to deliver a product to market,
so it's
whatever
that might be.
So it's an
intensive training course.
Intensive training. You're looking at contracting. You're looking at how to run budgets. You're looking at marketing. All of those skills.
We're not calling it an intensive training course anymore. We're calling it a boot camp.
It's a business development.
And an accelerator is where you say to people, okay, you have to be arriving here ready to go because we're not mucking around.
Correct. Okay. And you get invited into that. And in this instance, with this Foundry 658 initiative, you come in, you get $20,000 seed money to support your business starting up, and you get a process of really intense kind of acceleration. And that's where you're picking apart your ideas, you're testing them out with audiences, you're testing them out the market, you're working out, is there a need for the business that I'm developing? And that might be a new fashion label, or it might be a company who's got a really fantastic way to present their theatrical product in site-specific places around the regions, whatever it might be. How do you tighten that up into a really great commercial product that can go out to market, can attract investment, and be a sustainable business that's going to create jobs and income and, you know, contribute to our economy as well as to our cultural life? And that's what's super exciting for us.
Okay, so $20,000, I presume you don't just have to fill in a one-page form to get $20,000. There's a bit more to it than that.
Absolutely. You've got to have gone through the boot camp process. We have identified you through that process as being coming with a high potential idea.
So the 20 grand comes after
that.
So you cherry pick from the boot camp.
Totally.
The superstars who you think are worth investing in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then they might turn into the next crumpler.
Precisely. Yeah.
Which started out in exactly that way.
Totally.
A couple of bike couriers in Melbourne who wanted to come up with a better bag for bike couriers.
And
now it's a global brand.
Look at that flourishing. And so I suppose it's that injection. It's that kind of artificial insemination. How do you kind of just dive into the sector and fast track a hold of that activity? And it's these kinds of interventions that can do it.
And they won't all work. They just won't.
They won't. Of course not. But if you get 20% of them working, that can have a massive impact.
I'd have thought 2%.
I mean, we'll see. I mean,
but no, anything. Well, and sometimes you might find something doesn't work at first, but then it comes back a few years later, reinvented, repackaged, rethought, and can succeed.
Totally.
Or it contributes to someone else's idea.
And that's the other thing. Seeing, being around other companies that are doing that same process alongside you is fantastic for inspiration, for understanding, for collaboration. Those things can't be underestimated either. And that's been the other really hard thing for the creative industry sector. It's all being done in isolation. Now it's about bringing them together and sharing what people have learned as well to the broader sector. So it's really fantastic. And look,
it's been an eye-opener for us, actually. Yeah. We know a kid who is a professional gamer.
Yes.
Gamer developer.
Yeah.
Building games. And we all thought, oh, really? Grow up, get a real job. And he and his friends have just come back from a sales mission in California, and they're being courted off to go to Tokyo to meet some people there. And what we all thought, that we being, you know, the parent generation, all thought was just a childish, frivolous waste of time, is potentially a very commercially successful development. And you go, well, actually, they might have spent a few years in their room, we thought, wasting time. They've actually invented something that the world might want.
And look, I mean, the games industry is a multi-billion dollar global industry.
And people have not woken up to that.
And
well,
in
sorry,
Melbourne,
some people haven't.
In Melbourne, it is, people are looking all over the world at what's happening in Melbourne. It's a remarkable games community here. The the success and creativity that's being generated out of Melbourne and Victoria at the moment in the games sector is amazing. And we've got 48% of the Australian industry here. It's watch this space.
Yeah, so you've got kids who are learning, you know, cartooning and animation at the College of the Arts, and they get snapped up the minute they walk out the door.
And it's such a kind of creative part of the industry. It's as much about storytelling as it is about code. You know, it's the content that you always come back to. I mean, this is an absolute core part of what we're doing at ACME.
Now, you mentioned regional. I've already got text messages here. Tracy in Geelong saying, Geelong has been named as a UNESCO City of Design, which was about a month ago.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of exciting things happening, and not just in Geelong, but partly because of the cost of living of central Melbourne and greater Melbourne. A lot of people are saying, well, actually, a lot of this stuff doesn't need to be done in the capital city.
Absolutely. Geelong, Ballarat, Bendigo, Shepparton, I mean, all over. And this is what's so exciting about, you know, working in this kind of new digital age, is that you don't have to be in the middle of Melbourne to have a hugely successful business. And I think that's what's so important about this kind of regional component to this new Foundry 658 program, is that it is going to span the whole state, because that's the reality of where these creative startups are, you know, developing.
The pace of change, though, we'll raise this, I'm sure, with our guests, Melis and Sarah, who are coming in just a moment. That sort of scares a lot of people.
Well, it is a bit scary.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was the Industrial Revolution, which happened pretty fast. Now there's the Digital Revolution. Yep. You know, so we've just to bring it back to ACME, we've just received, $35 million from the government to reimagine our institution. We celebrate the moving image. Now, our permanent exhibition opened a decade ago, hugely successful, really, really interesting. But there is a sign in it that says 1991 to the present day, and it talks about digital technology. And there's a little glass dome, and in it is an iPhone 3. Now, you think about what's happened since 2009, when the iPhone 3 arrived in Australia.
Not even another decade.
To what's happened now. Mm. It is phenomenal. It has completely disrupted broadcasting. It has disrupted, I mean, it has disrupted our cultural lives, the way that we socialise, the way that we communicate, the way that we consume content. It's been transformative in a decade.
And it's not even started.
It's powering at full pace ahead. And it's thrilling, and it's hugely challenging. And it is a bit scary, because jobs are changing, and we all have to change, and we all have to adjust. And I think, again, that's why this kind of investment is super, super important.
We live in revolutionary times, so let's harness it. Trina Sedgwick from ACME is my co-host. I'm John Fain. Now, first two guests are talking about the Creative State Summit that comes from the initiatives Katrina was telling us about just a moment ago. It's at the Melbourne Museum on Thursday and Friday next week, and it's called Creativity in a Post-Truth World. And Sarah Moran, co-founder of Girl Geek Academy, is one of the participants. Morning to you, Sarah.
Morning.
And Dr. Melissa Nova from a business called Huddle, who's also a member of the Creative State Advisory Board, is also going to be on the panel. And Melissa, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're described as a human-centred designer.
I am.
Isn't all design human-centred?
I wish it was. I really do. There are certain decisions that we make as designers that can be functional around, does my design meet this function, which we spoke about the Industrial Revolution before. That's basically what that was all about, functionality and utility. And the human experience of that is often left to the very end, when the thing that we've created goes out into the world, and then we realise whether or not we've had a good impact or a negative impact. And what human-centered design does is try and bring the consideration of the person up front when you're making the initial decisions around what the design ought to be.
Can you give me an example?
Unintended consequences of design. I'll give you an example. So from my own life, when I was doing my PhD, I did it with the Defence Department, and I'm originally a biomedical engineer. And I was interested in helping pilot workload and reducing that. And to be able to do that, I wanted to use the auditory system more efficiently than the way that they were doing it. At the moment, pilots were visually overloaded, and they weren't performing as well as they could.
So the pilot would have too many instruments and
too
dials.
Too many instruments, too many
screens.
Things to look at, yeah. Yep. And the hearing system wasn't being used at all. And so I was looking at how we could deliver more information in a way that was actually reducing the workload for the pilot so they could be safer and fly better. And that technology had the intention of having a good impact on the pilots in making them feel less workload. But what happened post my PhD was that very same technology was used in a completely different context, which was around weapon systems. So the intention of human-centered design is to be able to control the design context, to be able to say what it is that we're actually designing here is to have this positive impact on humanity, and we care less about whether or not it's going to be functionally accurate at the beginning of the design process, which is what I was trying to bring to the scenario.
So, sorry, were you making sure that there were instruments they would attract your attention, not because a needle was moving, but because there was a sound?
Yeah, I'm trying to keep it really...
So there'd be alarms.
So it was 3D audio. It was three-dimensional
noises saying, have a look at this one, have a look at that one. You can forget the rest until they make a noise.
Yeah.
So if the fuel pressure's too low, it'll go bing, 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 bing.
That's right. Well, it was actually a little bit more sophisticated than that. It was, with our auditory system, we can do two things at the same time. We can deliver location information and we can deliver content. So you can go, that sound is coming from over here, and you can also hear the message that's coming from that location. So you can do two things at once with the auditory system that you
sure.
can't do with the visual.
But I can
so
have...
that's what I was, that's I what
can
I was
have
doing.
Over there.
Yes.
And at the same time, I can have over here.
That's right.
And in fact, I've only got two hands. I can't clap and click my fingers at the same time. You could have those happening at the same time, and my brain can distinguish between them.
That's right, in terms of what the sound is and where it's coming from.
I think it's what about something like the typewriter keyboard?
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking of user-centred design and human-centred design and something as simple as a keyboard that we work on each day, and the issues around RSI and how it's had to be kind of reverse engineered or shifted to kind of manage repetitive strain injury that comes from that kind of relentless.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know is that what you mean?
Katrina, do you know what you just said?
What?
Typewriter keyboard.
Yes. Oh, my goodness, I did.
Yes. I don't know what that is, Katrina.
Sarah, thank you very much. And you would represent a different demographic.
Hi, I am the nerd here today, but from a very tech-savvy-centred place. It's funny because in tech startups we talk a lot about human-centred design because what happens... So we talk about having the hacker, the hustler and the hipster as being the three core members of a team, and the designer really plays that role. Like the hacker gets in and goes, I just want to build this great tech. Like, that's what I want to do. And then the designer comes along and goes, yeah, but who's going to use it? And really interferes early on in the process, so the technology doesn't build this fancy piece of, you know, tech art that no one can actually use. So they get in early and they have those early conversations.
Yeah. Yeah, and what does the hustler do?
So the hustler makes sure that people then actually buy it.
Right.
They make a profit from the fact that other people buy it.
Yeah. They tell people about it.
But that's the entrepreneur, and you need the
Absolutely.
Designer, you need the inventor, the designer who refines it, and the
that's
entrepreneur
right.
who monetizes and makes sure. I mean, there's no point coming up with something that you can't afford to build or no one's going to buy. Or
That's
if
right.
you do build it, it's unaffordable.
Mm. Absolutely.
And the buzzword so much now is user experience.
Yeah.
That's what everybody is talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
what does it mean, though?
It means to be thinking about the end user the whole way through.
Well, in a design term, how do you then... Okay, I mean, I've already had a go once about the jargon in all of this. User experience, what does that actually distill down to in the design process?
Okay, so there's... There's the user experience, and then there's also the customer experience, and there's people that like to separate the two as well. So the user experience is often defined as making the design as empathic to the person who's actually going to be using the system that you're creating.
So I buy a pair of shoes and I wear them. If the user experience is that they're uncomfortable, then I don't wear them anymore.
Yeah.
And I've wasted my money and I won't buy that brand again.
Yep. So you can think about it that I was going to define that as the customer experience. The user experience is usually the people inside the organisation that actually need to deliver the service to the customer. And you have to design for them as well because they are also people. And then there's the customer experience, which is the person who's interacting with the product or the service that the business is creating. So call centres are a beautiful example of this. So the organisation might have this gorgeous service experience for their customers where they feel waiting times, and when they are on the phone, they're feeling supported and they get the information that they need. So they've got that aspiration for the customer. But they actually don't design the systems and the screens and what the call centre staff actually have to deal with to be able to deliver that service to the customer. So there's two different things that you have to design for. It gets very complicated very quickly.
I would love if you had some more call centres as clients, because I tell you what, I don't think I've ever had a positive customer experience.
It's a real challenge. Yeah, absolutely.
Just don't use phones. That's my...
Yeah, good luck. And that works out. So what's Girl Geek Academy about, Sarah?
So Girl Geek Academy is about encouraging more women to build tech startups. That includes creative tech, and also just to have more women building the internet. If you think about how much we use our phones and our computers all day, every day, we don't think about the fact most of that software has been built by men, mostly American men, actually. And there's a whole world that can be created that we're waiting for more people to participate in. We actually don't even have enough engineers full stop building the internet. But I love creating more women friends and encouraging them to come along and learn how to build technology and create these solutions that we want to see in our future.
It's interesting. We were talking about the games industry before, this massive global industry. 48% of people who play games are women. So the stereotypes that we think of as being little boys in their bedrooms, that's not what it is anymore. 48% of players are female.
I've seen them on the train on the way home every day.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Game players
unbelievable.
Are everywhere.
Everyone is... You think they're on their phone, checking their Facebook status or the news. No, they're playing games.
Yeah. But only of that industry, of the 48%, audience end, only 10% of the people creating it are female. So we've really got to push. And so what are the kind of initiatives that you're doing to kind of lure women in, sort of get past these sort of stereotypes to invite them in?
And I think some of it is, it's not women's fault there aren't enough women building it. We just need to open up some of those career pathways and make sure when they get there, they're working in an inclusive environment. And we're lucky that the Australian games industry, so it's a major exporter for Australia, because when you sell games, you don't just have to sell them locally, you can sell them overseas. And we're really lucky that we have all these new companies emerging. And so a lot of women now are starting their own games companies, and they're creating new types of games as well and new different types of collaborations. And so we run hackathons for women. And so that could be, we might get them to build a tech startup. But these days we've just run one. It was called She Hacks Games, and we ran it out of The Arcade, which is a co-working space just for games developers, which means they all work with their games companies out of the one space. And then we got them to build a game over a weekend. So at She Hacks Games, we held a three-day event. It was a two-day event. They came in on the Saturday morning and we said, right, here's your hacker, hustler, hipster. Get started, get cracking, and by Sunday evening, we want to see a game. Now, they all managed to ship a game. Some of them felt like they were stuck together with sticky tape, but they got across the finish line. And so we had over 60 women building games together, which was... And then we had a play party where we all played each other's games. So it was great.
And were they any good?
Oh, some of them were terrible, but but they got them done. And so a lot of these women...
And lots of terrible things, people learn.
It was fun.
To make mistakes in order to get things right.
And some of them were incredible. Actually, they were all incredible because everyone had learned something through the process. So we had one game where the people decided to use one of the new voice recognition systems. So it was Alexa. And they created Harry Potter spells that you would say Harry Potter spells to your Alexa, and then you had this game off the back of it. Which sounds ridiculous. But, they learned how to do that. So they programmed their Alexa. That's probably double geekery there with the Harry Potter on top of the Alexa. What else did we have? We had this group created a dog walking game where you'd just walk around your neighbourhood collecting dogs and take them walking, and you could collect the Pomeranian or the Labrador and you'd go walking.
Sorry, this is for helping out friends who are still at work late at night but the dog needs to be walked.
Yeah, you can walk. No, just walk your virtual dog.
A virtual
in the game.
Dog. Okay, right.
John.
I thought maybe it was an app for helping out your neighbours.
No, nothing as ambitious as that.
Okay, there's a hidden key which you can get in order to help out your friends who you normally see at the park, but if they're late that night, you can go and...
Sounds like you should come to our next game jam.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be a great idea because I actually know someone who would benefit from that very, very much. And, you know, you're stuck at work, you've got a late night, and you know the dog is desperately waiting for you to come home, probably tearing a pillow apart. So, you'd love to. That'd be a brilliant app.
It's a game, John. It's a very game. I want to play with that pillow ripping dog.
I'm much too practical.
Yeah, I can tell.
Real world. So, Melissa, this is the million-dollar question everyone's got, really, isn't it? What's coming next? If this is where we've gone, as Katrina's reminded us, in the space of little more than, 15 years, really, since the ball started really, really running fast.
Do you mean in terms of my industry or do you mean in terms of the role of creative industries in the state?
The tech revolution. We're living in revolutionary times. The world has changed.
Yeah.
There are people left behind.
Yeah.
There are people missing out. There are people who are just running around with their fingers in their ears going, ah, don't want to hear, don't want to know, can't bear it. But for the rest of everyone who is, usually at some stress level and anxiety is going through the roof, people who are struggling to keep up, what's next?
Well, what I'm finding actually is what we're paying attention to is changing. So we spoke about the pace of change, we spoke about the role that technologies continue to play in our lives, and that's getting more and more and more. The topic that I'm going to be talking about at the summit is actually the dark side of design, which is becoming more and more interesting, a topic that I'm hearing come up, bubbling up in other places, other conferences, which is actually asking questions around the more moral and ethical implications of tech. And just because we can build it, should we? And I think what's coming next is a really strong focus on how we bring those practices that philosophers and people who've studied ethics have been, trying to wrestle with for centuries, into the very practical decisions that we make around what we actually end up building.
I think I read that Elon Musk said one of the biggest threats of our time is artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so this is interesting because there's a really great two books actually by a gentleman called Harel. I'm not going to get his name right. He wrote Sapien and Homo Deus. Yuval Harari. And the first book that he wrote was A Brief History on Humankind, and the second book is A Brief History on the Future of Humankind. And he talks about the role of artificial intelligence in humanity. He's a historian and an anthropologist. And I think it really depends on the very topics that we're talking about right now, which is what are the things that inform the decisions that we make about what we choose to design? Because it could be a dystopian future or it could be a utopian future. And I think what's happening next is that focus.
So let's see where we go.
Yeah.
Which way does it go? Melbourne Museum is the venue for the Creative State Summit, and they've got their very own website. Of course they do. They've probably got a game as well. Creativity in a Post-Truth World at the Creative State Summit, Thursday and Friday next week, 14, 15 June, at the Melbourne Museum. It's not too late for you to register and go along. Creative State Summit. And our guests explaining it to us have been Dr. Melissa Sonova, who's the founder and CEO of Huddle. She's part of the Creative State Advisory Board. And Sarah Moran, who's from Girl Geek Academy that she started up. Katrina Sedgwick from ACME is my co-host. Our next guest is over here from New York. The Melbourne Winter Masterpiece Exhibition at the NGV is some stuff, some sort of spare parts from the Museum of Modern Art in New York, MoMA. It's one of the biggest draw cards in the world, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Well, they very generously lent us some of their, it's not spare parts, it's not bits and pieces, it's some of the absolute jewels in their crown are coming over here for the Winter Masterpiece, and Juliet Kinchin will take us through it next. It's 22 to 12 on The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria Digital Radio and the World Wide Web. And if you do go as a tourist to New York, one of the absolute guaranteed places that you will visit is the Museum of Modern Art. Well, hey, guess what? You can save on the airfare because the Museum of Modern Art is coming to you. Melbourne Winter Masterpiece Exhibition opens on Saturday. That's the 9th of June. And we've picked the eyes, apparently, out of the Museum of Modern Art, out of MoMA's collection. And Juliet Kinchin's put a bit of bubble wrap around it all and brought it out here for us. Morning to you, Juliet.
Good morning.
Juliet joins Sarah Moran from Girl Geek Academy, Melissa Sanova from Huddle, and Katrina Sedgwick from Acme here to tell us all about this new winter masterpiece. What are we going to get?
Oh, we're rolling out our treasures for you. Really, it's a phenomenal journey from an early painting by Georges Seurat of 1886 right through to very contemporary moments in art. And it covers everything from ball bearings to Picasso and Dali.
And pop art in between.
And pop art in between. We have, for all those music lovers, a phenomenal 1957 Fender Stratocaster on view, right next to your own Martin Sharp's LP cover for Cream. So I think there is genuinely something for everyone in this exhibition, whatever your age or interests.
So it's a piece of remarkable timing, and Tony Elwood and the NGV have, you know, initiated a partnership with your esteemed institution in the most fabulous way. How come we've been able to access all these wonderful works? Why were we able to get them here to Melbourne?
I mean, it's been a really long and involved negotiation. I mean, I have to pay credit just to the ambition of the undertaking. I mean, I think you possibly visitors don't realise, well, we don't really want them to realise how much effort and angst goes into getting the work here. We want them to just engage with these amazing works of art. But it is such an undertaking. It takes not just the curators. There are three of us. We've been Skyping, poring over models and
you're going through a renewal at the moment.
Yeah. So that helped release some of our really key works. So we've had to slow down our own exhibition program as we're in the process of expanding our campus.
And the other really thrilling thing, I think, about this exhibition is that, I mean, you're with design and architecture.
Yes.
But what's amazing is that curators from every single department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York have engaged with the curation of this show.
Yes.
I think that's so interesting, the way that it's not a painting show.
Well, and architecture and design, as you all know, are, you know, profoundly collaborative practices. And I think that's very evident in the way the exhibition has come together. But I think it's also in keeping with the ethos of MoMA from the start, which was to try and represent the full breadth of innovation and excellence in artistic practice, whatever form it took. So right from 1929, we had a department of film, a department of architecture and design, and that's really, really unusual.
It is. I suppose it's reflecting that word modern,
yes,
isn't it?
Modern
it's
and contemporary.
Very, yeah.
So obviously modern life is so complex and confusing and challenging, and, you know, the one constant is change in this 130 years we're covering.
So we get a Warhol, we get Edward Hopper.
Just one Warhol.
Oh, how many?
Well, it's a full set of Marilyns, which will
The iconic Marilyns.
Yes.
Fabulous.
Wow.
Fabulous.
You,
Jackson Pollock.
Jackson Pollock, yeah. Frida Kahlo. What are the names? I mean, I think, you know,
Picasso, there are, Matisse, Van Gogh.
Yeah.
Jeff Koons.
They're all there.
Tick, tick, tick. But it's not a name-dropping exercise. When we have these winter masterpieces, sometimes they're specific artists, but other times when it's a collection like this, it's the ones we don't know or hadn't previously seen rather than the ones we have an instant recognition of that blow the lid off your head. So who should we look out for?
Well, in the very first gallery, you know, one of my favourite objects is this colossal railway carriage spring. It's just full of compressed latent energy. I don't know who actually designed it, but it's been in our collection since the Machine Art Exhibition of 1934. So it's not always about the big names. But going through, you know, the most recent work in the exhibition is a woven hanging which takes the form of a map of a refugee camp, which was woven by this whole group of Sahrawi women working with Manuel Hertz, an architect, to really map this huge camp where they've been living for nearly 35 years.
In tapestry?
In tapestry.
And using
it's a wonderful, touching object.
So it's fabric tapestry?
Yes.
Wow.
Woven.
I mean, the other really exciting thing, I think, I mean, I'm just looking here at the curatorial departments, and I think it's worth just going through them. Architecture and design, drawing and prints, film, media and performance art, painting and sculpture and photography. And that diversity of practice juxtaposed together through this prism of 130 years of kind of radical artistic innovation is very interesting. It sounds like it's going to be quite eclectic and full of curiosity.
Yes, curiosities. I mean, I think that's it. Rather like taking the dog for a walk. You want to go one way and the dog will probably take you another. You're going to be pulled in different directions, but I hope you're really going to see these connections, but also that kind of human and ineffable dimension of design. It was so interesting to see that your whole company is called Huddle, which is the name of a performance work in the exhibition, which is going to appear at points in the course of the exhibition, which is all about a group of people sort of developing a trust between themselves and building a construction of their bodies in the exhibition.
So it's a performance.
It's a performance.
Within a gallery.
Yes.
You'll get into trouble here.
So it becomes a human huddle, quite literally.
A human huddle.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a human huddle.
Yeah.
Well, I'm all for the touchy-feely parts of the exhibitions. You know, you talk about where the dog lead takes you through an exhibit, and I'm always straight to the kids section. So is there anything that is that sort of high-touch engagement for the curious like me?
Well, for the gamers, I mean, it's, from your point of view, a retro experience, but we can introduce some of our younger members to Space Invaders. There
Woo-hoo!
Are a couple of consoles there.
Pac-Man.
We've also tried to keep abreast, obviously, of changing design practice in the way we collect and present these issues. So the at symbol, you know, so much a part of our email culture, or the emojis, these are items that have entered our permanent collection and are on view in the exhibition.
I'm excited.
can I ask a question?
Do we start on emojis? Where do we begin?
I was actually just going to ask a question about how you make the decision that something then becomes a part of the collection or not.
Because intense, heated debate. And, you know, it's about tracking developments often over years, or individual designers and companies. Yes, there's a lengthy process. You know, we don't just stuff anything in
of
the
course.
Collection.
Yeah.
But emojis are now part of the collection of the Museum of Modern Art.
Emojis are now part of the collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
And they have been, without a doubt, a transformative piece of design and kind of a creative intervention in our lives in ways that are unexpected, continue to be surprising.
I'm just processing that.
It's almost like the modern hieroglyphics, right, where we used to speak in pictures. We're doing that again in facial expressions.
And it's a global language.
It's universal. Really you can communicate with someone with whom you have no common tongue. And you can communicate in emojis if you're nimble enough, and people are. And now there are apparently apps where you can design and adapt emojis to suit your specific individualised purpose.
I love being communicated to by a GIF. I really like...
Now you
I
have
really
to explain,
like,
just there will be people who are saying, what language are you talking?
So it's a tiny little short loop of like a couple of seconds of a clip, and it loops, and it just communicates a single message to you. So
you may have, for instance, you may want to express shock or laughter.
Yes.
And so you find a clip from someone in a film where someone's laughing boisterously and you just send them that little 3-second
Correct.
Clip.
Or you're feeling a bit clumsy and you send a little clip of a puppy falling off a washing machine or, you know, whatever it is. I enjoy them.
I think the piece for you in the exhibition then is Christian Markley's compilation called Telephones, which is these few second clips from telephone encounters on film.
What, audio?
No, it's a film.
Okay, a film of people on phones.
Yes.
I mean...
From that you will recognise, iconic moments in films from a wide...
Well, look, I guess this is the sort of thing, Katrina, that you do at ACME, the role of the phone in our creative extension, the way we are... using phones as the absolutely standard tool for everything.
It's a museum in your pocket.
Yep.
Actually.
And actually, in the very first gallery, there's an 1890s poster by Jules Chéret, advertising the teatrophone. That was dial-up music on your phone.
In
the 1890s, you know, there's nothing new, really. And it shows this fashionable Parisian woman who's just put in her 25 centimes to this phone box, and she's listening to live opera on the teatrophone.
That's so fantastic.
I mean, when you hear the quality of those early recordings, I'm sure it was a bit like a drowned cat.
I worry about her phone bill. Like, you know, just sitting there listening to the opera for hours, that's going to cost her quite a bit in the 1890s.
But there was no other way if you were not where the opera was, and we take all of this for granted now, and that's how much our expectations and our whole worldview, our whole perspective of what it means to contribute, to participate, it's totally changed.
And I suppose that's one of the really attractive things about a show that's spanning this kind of particular time frame. You know, the last 130 years, I mean, that's when the moving image was invented, 130 years ago. You know, just sort of post-industrial revolution, like, you know, trains, film, machine guns. The world just changed forever, and fascinating what's happened in that kind of art space through that era, mapping it up to now, and the different stories that artists want to tell, and the same stories that
and
artists
I think,
want to tell.
You know, talking about the darker side of design in the second section of the exhibition, which is called Machinery of the Modern World, it's looking at responses of artists and designers to the impact of machines in the early 20th century. So someone like George Grosz, the German artist, picturing the devastating impact of the First World War, this explosion of his environment. And someone like Fernand Léger, the French artist who himself was gassed in some of the trenches in Verdun, but he presented a more celebratory, positive view of machines in his artwork called Propellers. So, you know, seeing the utopian and dystopian effects of these new technologies is something artists have been wrestling with.
And
Sorry, do go on.
And I wonder whether or not the impact of technology is not as obvious as the impact of machines, perhaps, sure. Because, you know, we're looking at obsolescence and people becoming redundant and all of that sort of stuff because of automation. And that's happening in people's homes. They're not necessarily getting physically displaced. They're living in the same place, in the same city, but still a massive impact. So I just wonder how we're going to deal with all of that, actually.
And there's the start of another entire conversation. Absolutely. Juliet, I don't have time to go to the exhibition, as do thousands of other people, so I presume that you're using technology to bring the exhibition to me, he says cryptically.
That is a bit cryptic, but I'm sure, I mean, the,
can you,
it will
can
be
you have
covered
a virtual,
in the...
Can you have a virtual tour of the exhibition to tie in the creative state where we are? In fact, it doesn't matter how long it's there for, people will make time, and we've seen the crowds that descend on NGV year after year after year. But if I was one of those people who couldn't get there, can we do a virtual tour?
I mean, there's a huge social media program and online coverage of the exhibition, but there's nothing beats actually really engaging face-to-face with these artworks.
Completely agree, but even if hundreds of thousands of people, and they will, descend, there's still many, many more. Yeah. It would be wonderful if we could do some of that, if we could, use the Geek Girl Academy or whatever it might be to create a virtual tour of some of these exhibitions, and they're there for everybody.
And there's an amazing digital team at NGV who really capture the feeling of a lot of those experiences. And the reality is, for museums and galleries now, we all have to do that all the time.
And we have a huge online audience, millions and millions, probably larger than our physical visitation. But they're not mutually exclusive.
No. In fact, the one should lead to the other. It's not that you're cannibalising your customers. You're actually augmenting what they're offered. The Museum of Modern Art at NGV. So MoMA at NGV 130, a Melbourne Winter Masterpiece Exhibition, opens on Saturday until the 7th of October. It is magnificent. I've just been given the catalogue to look through, and it is a blockbuster. Sarah Moran, and Juliet Kinchin is the curator from MoMA who's here. Sarah Moran from Girl Geek Academy and Dr. Melissa Sonova from Huddle have been here to talk about Creative Victoria, and Katrina Sedgwick from Acme has been my co-host.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.